ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. The Territory Government has unleashed hundreds of ladybirds to destroy an exotic pest that is hammering frangipani trees around Darwin. But is it working? Are the ladybirds having a win in the war against papaya mealybug? You'll find out soon. Also today, a trip to the Morara Footy Oval, which recently played host to the muddiest NTFL Grand Final ever.
For the Grand Final, we'd had about 240 mil or 270 mil for that week, and the amount of games through the week really churned the field up with the foot traffic. It basically ended up looking like a paddy field. We could have grown rice on it.
It was full of mud. How's it looking now ahead of tonight's NRL game? You'll find out before 1:30. We're broadcasting across the territory on the ABC, and g'day to those who have downloaded the podcast. First up today,
it was in the news, and they were doing the crocodile roll. The husband and the reptile doing the crocodile roll. In the middle of the river.
This week, Darwin has played host to an international crocodile conference, which attracted about 200 delegates from around the world. Our very own Dan Fitzgerald was there, hanging out with the who's who of the crocodile industry. And Dan, you've managed to speak to a crocodile farmer. You managed to get an interview, which is not an easy task these days, is it?
No, it's not, Matt. There are actually a bunch of friendly researchers, crocodile experts, university professors there at the crocodile specialist groups working meeting this week. But when it comes to the farming sector, well, it's notoriously a bit of a closed shop. Mm. And part of the reason for that is that almost all of the farms here in the territory, they're either owned by the big fashion houses of Louis Vuitton and Hermes, or they're controlled by them. And those companies, well, they keep a pretty tight leash on their operations.
Yes.
And most of the workers on those farms, well, they've all signed non-disclosure agreements, so they can't speak about what they get up to. Mm.
And it's not just the workers on the croc farms. I know a company here in Darwin who got a contract to do some work for one of the croc farms. Even they had to sign an NDA.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. I actually spoke with a croc farmer from overseas at this conference. He had a lot of interesting things to say to me off the record about the industry, but he just wasn't able to do an interview that we could put to air. There actually was a spokesperson for Louis Vuitton at the conference. They talked about carbon emissions from crocodile farming, but I just wasn't able to interview them. But I did able get to speak to an alligator farmer from the US state of Louisiana.
Here we go, a gator farmer.
Right there in the south outside of New Orleans. Nathan Wall's family, they farmed alligators for nearly four decades. And he told me about his operation.
Yeah, we've been in the business now for 38 years and very unique in conservation, biosecurity. And even what's really interesting is we go out, we collect the eggs. About, I must say, as early as 40 years ago, there was only 100,000 alligators in Louisiana. Today, there's over 3 to 5 million because of the farming practices and because of the releases that we put back. So a farm basically is where we go out, we collect the eggs. We come in, we incubate them, and then we will raise them and feed them an extruded pellet. And so in that process, then we got the meat that we feed to America, and then we also got the byproducts. Interesting, alligators is high in hyaluronic acid. So we're taking the byproducts going into wound care and actually even into skin care. So one of the skincare companies is Adrenity, and using hyaluronic acid from alligators to be able to even now not only save the world because of the carbon, because alligators is known to be the number one species to affect climate change positively. So you go from 100,000 as being an apex animal to over 3 or 5 million. Now it increased the marsh habitat and some of the rodents and critters that eats all the grass. Now the alligators eat them and the marsh grows and now it absorbs more carbon even.
Roughly how big is your farm?
It varies. We have multiple different farms. The state of Louisiana collects around 500,000 eggs a year. And so we have an opportunity to be as much as a third of Louisiana's production.
So you're a pretty big player then?
Some would say so.
If we can just go back to the feed that you mentioned there, you feed your alligators pellets. Tell us about that. What is it and why do you feed them pellets?
Yeah, so we actually feed as much as 13 times a week, twice a day, and then a lot of farms feed once on Sunday. So the animals are, I'm going to call it this way, they fed likely better than most people in America because they get fed so many times. But it's an extruded pellet, and what the companies have done, some of the feed companies of what they've been able to create, is what is a necessary nutrients for the crocodilians, which is alligators for the United States. So what they did is they took from what is the necessary needs from a crocodilian and then been able to create a pellet that is an extruded pellet. It's very high in protein. The average protein is around 50%. And then on a fat level, around 14%, then it has all the vitamin, mineral supplements that an animal would need to be able to thrive. And then that pellet also floats. So even if it gets off its pad, then it can get in the water and an alligator can still eat the extruded pellet because it also floats.
Do any farms feed their alligators meat?
None whatsoever. We literally are very familiar with all the farms. It's a small industry in the United States. The entire United States probably produces maybe a total of 350,000 production a year, and no one feeds meat back to the alligators. Now, when they're out in the wild and domestically, then obviously they're going to eat fish and some of the other varmints, and they're more meat in that aspect. But because of our extruded pellet, actually we took meat, broke it down, no different than they have the veggie patty. We created a veggie pellet for the alligators, and that way there's no meat fed back to them. So it's pretty cool.
Do you think they mind, the alligators?
They thrive. We do a lot of testing, so we do a tremendous amount of research. We have veterinarians as full-time. We also have a biologist and scientist as full-time at the farm. So we do all the testing upon the stress levels and upon growth. We track every aspect of everything. So they do not mind. Everyone I've asked said they have an excellent, satisfactory diet.
Now, there's a lot of products that come from an alligator farm, but probably the main one is the skin. What are the markets for your skin?
Actually, to some degree, I disagree with you, because when you look at the byproducts and you look at the meat, just our farm, within the meat that it produces, the value is around $5 to $6 million. So when you start looking at the amount of meat that is supplied to America, the concept of most people is there's farming crocodilians for the skins. And what we've been able to create is the skins is not wasted, but because of the tourism, because of the hyaluronic acid to where we're extracting to go into other companies. So I could give you some crazy numbers, but I'm going to give you a hypothetical. Within the amount of hyaluronic acid that is in one alligator skin, and you contribute that over to a retail price, that could be somewhere around $96,000. A skin could be valued at $100 or $200. So is a skin a byproduct? Interesting question.
That uronic acid you mentioned there, tell us more detail about what exactly that's used for.
Well, we work with seven different universities. So the universities is determining, I mean, alligators is a dinosaur. You know, the crocodiles is a dinosaur. So how did they survive all these years when there's so many amount of species that didn't? And then how do they survive when they might get injured living out in the marshes and the wild? So it's really unique to watch what DNA makeup that's within that alligator can now contribute over to humans that could help sustain our lives further. So we've been able to do that working with the universities. There was a talk here earlier about collagen. So there's so many different aspects that alligators are beneficial of by using the attributes of within that to help us even extend our own lives.
And some of your crocodiles, once you've collected the eggs, hatched them and raised them a little bit, actually get to return to the swamp. But what age and why does that happen?
Yeah, the way Louisiana set up its program, Florida only collects a percent of the eggs. They leave a percent. What Louisiana's program did when they set this up back in the early 80s, late 70s, was the fact that you collect a percent of the eggs, and then once the animal, once you bring them into your farm, after about a year, up to 2 years, once the animal gets about a meter and a half, then you take them animals and you release them back to where you collected the eggs from. So not only are you replenishing what has been removed, you're doing that by tenfold. Because the survival rate that was determined in the natural because of other, I'm going to call it other critters, and also because of Mother Nature. We get a lot of hurricanes and floods in South Louisiana. So then the survival rate was 4%. We're putting back 17%. So that was a huge differential. I wasn't part of the beginning of the program. Mr. Ted Johanna and Ruth Elsie and others created the program, and then the state of Louisiana has actually been a benefit of that. In the rural areas, you have rural areas here in Australia. Majority of the farms are located in very rural areas, and just for our state, you're looking at a quarter of $1 billion revenue for the state of Louisiana because of the alligator industry.
That is Nathan Wall, a gator farmer from Louisiana in the United States, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald at this International Croc Conference that's been on this week in Darwin. We really, really appreciate Nathan sharing time for the Country Hour.
Hello, my name is Salaudi Butongoleoi, and I am from Crocodile Island Rangers, one of the women coordinators, and you are listening to the Country Hour.
It's been a couple of weeks now since the Territory government unleashed hundreds of ladybirds onto suffering frangipani trees in the Darwin CBD. The job for these native ladybirds is to eat and destroy the exotic pest called papaya mealybug, which, as you know, has been causing lots of problems for frangipanis, hibiscus, pawpaws, all kinds of trees around Darwin. Now, we got a text during the week from Ron in Fenny Bay wanting an update on how the ladybirds were going. Were they winning the war against these mealybugs? So, to find out, let's have a chat to entomologist Dr. Brian Thistleton. Brian, how are the ladybirds going?
So the update is the actual ones on the Esplanade not doing so well as we'd hoped, but we've got other release sites. There's one in Palmerston where the ladybirds have built up quite a lot and they're giving good control. And we've got sites also where we're getting natural populations and really good control. The one on the Esplanade, I've just had a look now, and it does have quite a lot of ants. So I think we're going to need to control the ants and do another release because the ants will actually attack the larval ladybird. And this is an important thing for the listeners. If they're thinking of buying the ladybirds, make sure you do some ant control if you've got ants on the tree.
Right, because how many ladybirds has the government released now in the last few weeks?
Well, we've only done the one release. We're getting some more next week to do the release. Ours was more really to educate people as to what is possible. We're actually monitoring the ladybirds, and there are a lot of ladybirds building up naturally anyway. So, for instance, one of my colleagues went to a site she's monitoring in Winelli the other day, and on the trees there were the Cryptolemus, the ladybird that's been released, although we hadn't released in that locality, they'd built up naturally. There was another ladybird, there were green lacewings, there were surfeit larvae, but the householder was saying but the mealybug population's gone right down and the new leaves are clear. So it is working. It's just a matter of time as it builds up. But as I say, the one on the Esplanade will possibly have to do another release with an ant control as well.
I'm getting the impression there's a lot of Territorians that would love to get their hands on some of these lady birds. Did you hear the story, Brian, about the Mandora mealy munchers?
I did, and they've set up a group, and they're doing they're actually going to buy a bulk order of ladybirds. The guy who runs the group was in our lab yesterday, and he brought samples from a whole load of different plants so that we could verify that it was there. So at Wagoit Beach, they do have the papaya mealybug, but a lot of the samples they brought in were other. So there was cotton mealybug, which is a native species, gets on hibiscus and things. There's citrus mealybug. There's hibiscus psyllid. There's a whole range of different things that could be mistaken for them. So we're working with them, and they're going to be releasing, and we'll be checking on those. We're also interested on whether the parasitoid has got there, because the parasitoid is what I'm still thinking will give quite a lot of control. We've talked before about monitoring the yellow sticky boards, and we had a yellow sticky board where we had 300 parasitoids in Darwin. In that area, my colleague went back to there this week, and the frangipanis there were really badly hit, but they're now producing new leaves, and there's no mealybug on the leaves. So I think that's had
a
really good effect. Mm. It's a good sign. The trouble with the parasitoid is, it's working in the background, probably as effective or maybe even more effective than the ladybird, but you can't see it. Even on the sticky boards we use, it's like a tiny dot. Until you put it under the microscope, you can't tell what it is. So the gardeners aren't going to notice it. It's not something you can pick up easily.
It's definitely the ladybirds that have captured the audience attention, yes, and gardeners' attention. You've been in contact with the company that breeds up beneficial insects like this ladybird. What have they had to say?
Well, they commented that they'd had, after the release a couple of weeks ago that was on the radio, they said on the Monday they had an increase in orders. They said, what's happening? We're getting all these extra orders. And they continue to get extra orders. So, yes, that's they're noticing the effect. I mean, they're trying as much as they can to supply the need, but their ladybird culture or colony was at a low level, because this time of the year they don't normally have a big demand. They build it up when they've got, they're used in horticulture a lot, and they build it up in the season, but they'd let it go down to just a holding level. So they're rapidly building it up to supply the demand. And it's good for people to purchase them, but they are there anyway. So if people can, they will build up. I think now we're going into the dry season anyway, if they control the ants. But also, I don't want to, even though people won't see the parasitoid, I don't want to downplay that, because I think that's going to be very effective too.
And in all of your decades, Brian, of being an entomologist, have you ever seen the general public so interested in insects?
No. But it's interesting. You're probably aware of the spiraling whitefly that was a problem a few years ago, and we're still getting it. Some of the samples we're getting in are spiraling whitefly. But that was brought under really good control with a parasitoid. When that first got into Hawaii, it was in the town and it was causing similar damage to the papaya mealybug. It was lots of honeydew dropping on people's cars and all sorts of things. So, again, the public saw it. And then the USDA imported the parasitoid, which was really effective, a different parasitoid, but parasitoid for that. And they said to me that one of their entomologists said that was a situation where the public actually saw biocontrol in action. I mean, it's happening all the time in the horticultural areas and things, but it's not something that, people in town normally see. So there will be, hopefully, this will be successful and people will see how good the biocontrol is.
Yep, how important our beneficial insects are. Hey,
that's right.
Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour, Brian. Really appreciate it.
Okay, cheers.
The May issue of Gardening Australia is filled with growing goodness. Feast your eyes on gorgeous new release roses. Read about growing Proteus and Japanese Zelkova and take a fresh look at chrysanthemums. Visit an artist's garden, give your indoor plants a health check, learn how to maximise your veggie harvest and get tips on easy ways to compost. Available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
It is 7 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. The Territory election is coming up this year. Are you excited? You must be pumped. For 18-year-old Emma Porter, who grew up on Curtin Springs Cattle Station just east of Uluru, well, she feels that young rural Australians feel like their votes don't count. And she's actually recently been at a youth advocacy trip that was held in Canberra. She joined 150 other young Aussies to discuss issues impacting young people and had a chat to Victoria Ellis about why she was keen to get involved.
I just kind of wanted to be a part of something, and I wanted to be around people and meet people who were really motivated, because I found that I met a lot of amazing young people and people my age that wanted to do things for their community, that wanted to be a part of stuff that, you know, how can we make this better, or, you know, this is the challenge, and, you know, how can we give advice on this piece of legislation? How can we kind of do all of that? So that's the reason I put in the application.
What issues from the Northern Territory or the people living remotely is it that you want to sort of advocate for, or what is it you're hoping to bring to the group?
I'm hoping to bring experience of being remote. When you're isolated, when you live remote, even in a rural community where I'm living now, especially young people, it's hard to access certain things. Like, there's certain things that are just, you know, you've got to travel for, or there's like job opportunities, and it's really hard. Also, I have noticed that young people who are in kind of smaller rural communities kind of give up on that community. You know, what's the point of, especially if that community isn't perfect and needs some TLC, and there needs to be some things kind of happen. You know, there's kind of this, well, why would we? Which really sucks.
How much do you think agricultural issues or issues to do with primary industries, how much will that come up, do you think, in the sorts of works that you want to see happen, or the sorts of change that you want to see happen?
I do hope that it comes up, because being part of this advisory group, is we will be giving feedback on upcoming legislation or certain things that they want to make into legislation. Do I think agriculture will come up very often? No, because I don't think it does come up as often as someone from a farming background would like it. Kind of keeping people on farms. Farming is really expensive. When you think about it, you're looking at a lot of money, a lot of debt. Land at the moment is really expensive. It comes back to affordable housing. When you're looking at kind of stations in the Northern Territory, those stations are very expensive. Like, even in smaller, like, not stations, but other farms as well, is you kind of lose those younger generations in that farming community, because they've watched how hard it has been for their parents to have property and to run a farm, and they decide it's not for them.
I know you're only 18 and, you know, you're still figuring out your future, but what sort of things do you have in mind for your career?
I don't know, because there's a lot of opportunities and there's a lot of things that, like, I could go into. I love farming. I love it a lot. Is it a really hard life? Yes. Is it really rewarding? Yes. So I'd love to still be connected to agriculture in some way. Later in life, I have thought about becoming a chiropractor, as odd as it is, because in 2022, I found out that I had scoliosis, and going to the chiropractor really, really helped me. And something I've noticed that in a lot of rural communities, and some of the men do this more than the women, they won't go to the doctor, but they're happy to go to the chiropractor. there's a lot of different industries, and being really a part of and having the opportunities that I've had, you come to realize that you meet a lot of people, you make all those connections, and then suddenly there is so many doors.
That's Emma Porter, who grew up on Curtin Springs Station near Uluru, speaking to Victoria Ellis.
Hello, my name's Stephen Rose and I have a nursery just north of Catherine, and I love to listen to the Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon. For Landline, I've been looking at lamb and sheep prices today, and I have learnt that Iran's actually become a seriously big customer for lambs this year. So Iran is currently our fourth biggest customer for lamb, just behind the US, China and Dubai. So it's currently sitting in that fourth spot. It's been buying a lot of what's known as bag lambs from us. And that's why on Monday, the price for light lambs sort of fell off a cliff, because all of a sudden, this conflict erupted between Iran and Israel. There were a lot of flights cancelled. There were some flights that were actually redirected and turned around. And suddenly the processors, especially there in Victoria, just put away the checkbooks and stopped buying. And the national light lamb indicator fell by almost a dollar a kilo because of it. I just thought I'd share that with you. Before 1:30, as promised, we'll be heading out to the Murara Footy Oval, which recently played host to what was described as the muddiest NTFL Grand Final ever.
For the Grand Final, we'd had about 240 mil or 270 mil for that week, and the amount of games through the week really churned the field up with the foot traffic. It basically ended up looking like a paddy field. We could have grown rice on it.
It was a paddy field. How's it looking right now ahead of tonight's NRL clash? You'll find out soon. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick is there this afternoon. Beck, the tropical cyclone outlook for the weekend. How are things shaping up?
Yeah, the good news is that we have downgraded our risk assessment a little bit. We now just have a low chance of cyclone development over the weekend. So, that's the good news. We do have a low out there. It's north of Gove Peninsula, sort of halfway between the Top End and Papua, but didn't have a great night in terms of development. So that's why we've downgraded that risk.
Yeah.
And basically the conditions are becoming less favourable from Sunday onwards, with some dry air moving northwards through the territory.
I see Cape Wessel jagged 79 millimetres in the 24-hour period while this is going on. But I guess once this low disappears, Beck, are you willing to call it? That's the end of the wet season?
Oh, it's looking pretty close, isn't it? Mm. It's, not getting too much happening out there at the moment. We are getting that dry air pushing in. But northeast Arnhem area is still getting a bit of rain, as you said, but not so much elsewhere. And that's looking like continuing across the weekend, pretty much just that northeast Arnhem coastal areas experiencing further rainfall. But as I mentioned, there is this dry surge moving up through the territory, and starting to see a little bit of a sign of that around Catherine area with the humidity dropping a little bit. But that will do more so across the weekend and make its way up towards Darwin.
I see. The owl's expecting a top of 25 today, a top of 24 tomorrow. What are winds like, though, in the centre and especially in the Barkly?
Yeah, we have been seeing some windy conditions, so potentially getting up to 45 kilometres per hour around the Barkly area from today through the weekend. With this high pressure system to the south is relatively strong for this time of year. So those windy conditions will continue until Monday, Tuesday, when the winds will ease off a little bit as that high moves east.
And what about the weekend ahead for fishers, Beck? What can you tell them?
Yeah, there is a marine wind warning current at the moment. That's for conditions developing tomorrow, where we've got strong winds along the Beagle Bonaparte coast, the Gove Peninsula coast, and the Roper Groote coast. So windy conditions there, and that's likely to continue on Sunday as well. Perhaps not the best conditions to be out in a boat with these those winds out there, and generally fresh winds elsewhere. So, yeah, could be a bit choppy.
There's no fish out there anyway. Beck, I checked last week. There's just nothing out there. Yeah. All right, then. Anything else we need to be aware of heading into a weekend?
No, I think, most of the territory is going to be pretty sunny. So, it might be a good weekend to get out and about.
Beauty. Thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
Coffee for Tony Armstrong. Extra hot almond latte, light on the froth.
Yep, thanks, mate. Okay, so I like my coffee my way, just how I like my news. If you want to stay in the know your way, it's pretty easy. With the ABC News app or by heading straight to the ABC News website. Or if having emails in your inbox is the go, hit us up for newsletters. It's news your way. All the latest, all verified, all the time. That's a good coffee. Stay in the know with ABC News.
It is 11 past one. One of the big newsy stories this week was confirmation that Australia's chemical regulator, the APVMA, will stay in the regional New South Wales town of Armidale. An independent review by Ken Matthews recommended the APVMA go back to Canberra and get put inside the Department of Ag, but the federal government has rejected that recommendation. So APVMA stays put in Armidale. Bit of a background to this story. The reason why the APVMA is based in Armidale these days is because in 2016, the former Ag Minister, Barnaby Joyce, forced the organisation to move into his electorate, which resulted in about 90% of the APVMA staff leaving. Out they went. Following the move, the organisation was found to be captured by industry interests. There's been so many formal complaints made by staff. It's been a little bit of a mess. Barnaby Joyce, he's been interviewed about all of this. Let's have a listen.
Well, it's a typical sneaky, swindling language that you get from people who think you're so naive that you're going to swallow what they say when you don't actually look at the details. And we do look at the details, Minister Watt, and we do look at the details, Mr. Matthews. Now, yeah, they had a review, but I know how this game works. You ask for reviews, you already know your answer before you ask for the reviewer to review, to endorse your answer, to give it some legitimacy. And really, the source of this review is people in Canberra got terribly upset that we had the temerity to ask for a very small sense of decentralisation out of Canberra. And, of course, that doesn't suit the Public Service Union, the Commonwealth Public Service Union, and it doesn't suit the sort of zeitgeist of Canberra who believes that everything to do with taxpayers' dollars should be spent there. Now, what we've got is, as I said, the headquarters will remain in Armidale. However, the people who run the headquarters don't have to. And last year, out of the 14 executive decisions, 14, 13 were in Canberra. And, of course, that doesn't go too well for Armidale. They've got a new CEO starting. Do they have to live in Canberra? Live in Armidale? No, they don't. Are the vast majority of new employees being employed in Armidale or Canberra? Well, the answer to that is Canberra.
There is no denying, though, that there's been some pretty scathing reports of culture within the APVMA in Armidale. There's been some pretty awful reports of, you know, people urinating on colleagues at a Christmas party. I mean, obviously something has been not right within the APVMA.
A person who did the wrong thing who no longer works there. Now, let's use that rule in Canberra. Since that's the rule now for Armidale, and, of course, they said the culture's not right in Armidale. So they believe there's a whole city of barbarians or, there's some sort of genetic problem in Armidale and the whole city is somehow not worthy of a department. I mean, that in itself is an awfully big insult to everybody who lives in Armidale. And you've got to sort of listen to it and say to them, pull them up and go, hang on, what did you just say about us? I mean, what do you think? Do you think we're a lesser type of being, you know, to the sunny uplands and the enlightenment of Canada. I mean, yeah, go away. We can do this job just as well as you. And if that's the rule, now let's go to Canberra and apply that rule. And every time there is an issue, in any department, taxation department, Department of Social Security, Department of Defence, Parliament House itself, let's move it out. Because I tell you what, there seems to be a few issues going on around Parliament House lately. So are you moving that out of Canberra?
That's the member for New England, Barnaby Joyce, speaking to Christy Reading. If you missed coverage earlier in the week about the APVMA, set to stay in Armidale. That story is up on our website if you search for ABC Rural. Now, up next, you'll hear from a resources company that says it struck nickel and cobalt in a pretty remote part of the territory.
G'day, it's Brent Murdoch. I'm the Director and General Manager of Vista Gold. I look after the Mount Todd project, and we always listen to the Country Hour.
Yeah, so a resources company has found what it describes as a globally significant critical mineral asset of nickel and cobalt on a bit of country that's right on the corner of WA, SA and the Northern Territory border, if you can picture that part of the map. Nicco Resources says a mine at its Wingalina project could produce about 40,000 tonnes of nickel and 3,000 tonnes of cobalt every single year. The company's Kim Purvin says while the deposit looks promising, there's a few challenges facing the nickel game at the moment.
The demand for nickel continues to grow, perhaps reflecting the battery market. However, the supply has also grown enormously, such that there appears to be an oversupply at the moment, particularly coming out of Indonesia, which has seen a very substantial drop in the price. Now, the impact of the oversupply and the reduced price has meant that some operations or developing mines have had to take a step back and go into care and maintenance or cut right back, particularly in Western Australia.
What does it mean for Nicco though?
So, Nicco is in the development phase. The ones that have had to particularly step back are those in the construction phase and the operating phase. So in the development phase, I guess you could call it the study phase. Now, we've got some money in the bank. We're a small team. We will continue those studies. Some of them be desktop studies, some of them be laboratory studies and so on. And I'm talking here about geology and hydrology, our process engineering, because this nickel has to be processed on site. Of course, the non-process engineering like roads and logistic hubs, water supply. We will continue our work because we want to be ready to do a final definitive feasibility study, which will cost money. We need to have these studies ready to bring in a strategic partner to help fund this $3 billion project. And we want to be ready when the next window of opportunity arises and the nickel price increases.
When is it likely, do you think, to see that next opportunity come about? What is the sort of forecast in terms of nickel prices?
Really, to be honest, Tori, your answer to that question is as good as mine. So I can only refer you to safely what many analysts are saying, and that they expect nickel supply to exceed demand over the short term. They are also saying that the longer term outlook for nickel is strong.
So say in the longer term, however long the longer term may be, there is a strong demand. Do you think then it's likely that Nicco might be able to get some investment from people or companies who can see that, oh, hang on, this is our opportunity now to make some money?
Yeah, I mean, the market has to be growing. There has to be a need in the market. As I said, currently there's an oversupply. And the outlook for the product has to be very strong. So we're talking to potential investors in some of our friendly nations like Korea and Japan and the US and parts of Europe who are very interested in nickel. Let's just see how things pan out over the next 6, 12, 18 months. And perhaps what I didn't say is when we pull this nickel out of the earth, the whole logistics supply chain is looking like it's going to go through Alice Springs, you know, perhaps the Brewer Industrial State and then out through the Darwin Port, over 42 years. So it's a significant project which will bring social benefits and economic and regional development opportunities.
That is Kim Pervin from Nicco Resources speaking to Victoria Ellis. It is 20 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. About 4 weeks ago, the NTFL had what was described as its muddiest grand final ever. There'd been heaps of rain. There'd been a number of games on the oval there at Morara. And by the time the men's final started, it was just a mud bowl. Great for Buffalo. Not so great for footy players. Barely a blade of grass visible on one half of the oval. But since then, the groundskeepers, they've been flat out. They've been working hard to regrow the grass and get the oval ready for the NRL game that's on tonight between the Eels and the Dolphins. To see how this surface was looking, reporter and full forward himself, Dan Fitzgerald, swung by Morara and had a chat to head groundskeeper Denny Griffith.
Obviously, over the last few weeks, we've had a fair bit of work on trying to get the field back after it had its issues after the wet season. But we're in a good place, and I think tonight's game will be a good one.
Yeah, for those who didn't see it after the NTFL Grand Final, what did this oval look like?
For the Grand Final, we'd had about 240 mil or 270 mil for that week, and the amount of games through the week really churned the field up with the foot traffic. It basically ended up looking like a paddy field. We could have grown rice on it.
And now it is looking very pristine. It's marked up with lines. There's logos painted on it. The goalposts are all in. And yeah, as I said, the grass is looking voluptuous. What have you done in the past couple of weeks?
Like I say, there's been a lot of nutrition work going into it, a lot of aeration. There's been a couple of bits we've turfed out. But I mean, the key to all of it, even how bad it looked a few weeks ago, is the work that went into the field before that as well, just in our general annual programmes on the fields. It's just keeping a balance of everything working together, so the health's there.
What sort of fertiliser do you use?
We just use general NPK fertilisers, but it's going a little bit deeper than that. It's like keeping your calcium levels up, so then your NPK, your nitrogen, phosphorus and potassiums work properly. It's a bit like the human body. If you don't have your vitamin balances right, then one vitamin will work for something else. So it's exactly the same for grass, just that balance.
And are you out here doing soil tests and grass tests to know what to put on it?
We'll normally do like an annual soil test, which will get the results back, which will give us an indication of what's needed throughout the year. Obviously, that changes. It's a natural surface, so you just swing with the changes throughout the year. But you've got a general idea.
So are you happy with how it's turned out?
I'll never be happy. The day I say I'm happy, I'm lying. It's looking good. I'm pleased with where we are from where we were. A couple of little bits. I'd love to be a little bit better, but that's just me being a perfectionist.
Yeah, there is one bit on the wing that was most heavily damaged, but luckily where it hasn't quite regrown, it's just outside the NRL lines.
Yeah, like I say, that's not really going to be an issue. We'll probably even manage to disguise that even a bit more for tonight. But like I say, looking forward to a few weeks' time for the AFL. I think everything's going to be grown in properly and it should all be fine.
Yeah, the game is on tonight, but your work isn't done yet. What have you got to do today before kickoff?
Like I say, there's still a lot going on here. I'm going to give it a cut after I've done this interview, actually. Then I'll do another final cut around 2-3 o'clock this afternoon, just making it look as best we can. There's going to be field markings going on today and just general checking everything is where it's meant to be.
So how do you get those nice lines in the grass that you see on the telly?
With the type of grass we've got here, which is Legend Cooch, it actually takes a little while to burn a line into it for a stripe, so it's just I'm probably cutting these fields twice a day at the moment and have been for like the last week and a half, 2 weeks. So yeah, it's just persistently cutting in a direction
and making sure you're driving nice and straight. Or do you have auto steer?
No, I've just got a few years practice. It's all it's about.
And so success for a groundskeeper tonight in the NRL game, what does it look like for you?
Like I say, as long as we've got a true surface for the boys running on, because they're big lads, as long as nothing's ripping up too much, then I'm more than happy with that.
Good luck tonight.
Thank you very much.
Big thanks to Denny Griffiths, who's the head groundskeeper at the Morara Footy Ground, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald. That game between the Eels and the Dolphins is on tonight. It'll be good. And then the Gold Coast Suns will be taking on North Melbourne at Morara on Saturday the 11th of May. And there'll be another AFL game between the Suns and Geelong on Thursday the 16th of May. That wraps up today's Country Hour. It has been a busy, busy week. There's been a major resources conference on in Alice Springs. There's been an international crocodile conference on in Darwin. We've had our Catherine reporter out at a cotton field day in the Douglas Daly region. And, of course, that fiery Senate inquiry into supermarket prices. If you've missed any of this, you can catch it on our website or via the podcast. Keep it rural.